Good afternoon. Welcome. Thanks for being with us. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall here in Studio A, and my guest today is Otis Raleigh. He has recently been appointed as the president and CEO of the Baltimore Development Corporation, the lead economic development agency in the city of Baltimore. Raleigh's a longtime Baltimore resident who's held positions in local city government that include deputy housing commissioner and director of planning for Mayor Martin O'Malley and chief of staff with Mayor Sheila Dixon. He's also served as the president and CEO of the Central Maryland Transportation Alliance, and he's worked in government and in the philanthropy sector in several other cities. In 2011, he ran in the Democratic primary for mayor of Baltimore. Most recently, he was a social impact advisor for a financial firm in St. Louis. Otis Raleigh succeeds Colin Tarbert, who has left to take a position in Jacksonville, Florida. Raleigh's the first African-American to lead the BDC, and in an op-ed in the Baltimore Sun published in his first week on the job last June, he pledged to chart a new course for our city's economic future, and I am delighted to welcome him to the show today to talk about what that future might hold. Otis Raleigh joins me here in Studio A. You are welcome to join us as well. Our number here at midday, 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wipr.org. Otis, welcome back to town and welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm really glad you're here. So you talk about a new approach to economic development in this very well-conceived, well-executed op-ed that you published in The Sun. You said, for too long, economic development in cities across America has followed a familiar playbook. You lure big corporations with tax breaks, you polish downtown and measure success largely by promised tax revenue that doesn't always actually materialize in the end. So what's going to be different now in your tenure as the head of the BDC?
Well, first and foremost, thanks again for the opportunity to talk with you this afternoon. So what's going to be different is an intentionality around ensuring that everyone benefits from the economic development agenda of the city. We have an economic development strategy in Baltimore called Baltimore Together. It's a comprehensive economic development strategy that's focused in and on equitable economic development. And what I see as my job, my task, my calling, it's to ensure that we actually implement that strategy. Equitable economic development means that you don't just chase the big whales. When you hear about economic development, not just in Baltimore, but around the country, it's often, did you attract that company with 2,000 new jobs? Did you give them enough of a tax break to make it attractive enough for them to come? And while that can be a component, I never would say that we should reduce the tools in our toolkit to attract businesses here. But if you're talking about the health of a city, you really should be thinking about that, the whole city. And the big whales are as important as the trouts and the minnows, especially in a country like ours, where about 80% of the economic activity and growth is actually from small and mid-sized businesses. And yet all the attention often goes to those whales. And so what the new course that I'm talking about is one that's not new to me. It's not new to the field. Actually, when I was in charge of U.S. grant making at the Rockefeller Foundation, I helped to finance the equitable economic development strategy, a playbook for the International Economic Development Council to teach actually all of the economic development directors around the country and around the world that you can do this differently. And I see it as my task, my responsibility to really try to implement that here, to build a team that can do it, because I think it's consistent. Actually, I don't think I know. It's consistent with the mayor's goals and objectives for Baltimore. The strategy has been adopted, but we haven't been following it with fidelity. And so I see it as my job to actually make sure that we're following it with fidelity, that we're meeting the needs of those small, mid-size, and larger businesses, and that not just in terms of capital, but technical assistance and support, so that all of Baltimore prospers. It's not just how many jobs are created to measure whether an economic development team is being successful, particularly in a city like Baltimore. It's really seeing, is there economic mobility occurring? Do we see wealth being created? Do we see legacy wealth being created? Do we see neighborhoods changing in a way that both benefits those that were there and those that are looking to come there. And I think that's my job.
And that wealth development, that you know, creation of an ecosystem where, you know, lots of people can advance, would you characterize those as the sort of central goals of the mayor when you talk about the mayor and your goals? You know, what's the crux of that?
Yeah, most definitely. It is about wealth creation. It's about a reduction in the racial wealth gap that exists in Baltimore. As you're well aware, there were policies and procedures in place, sadly, for decades and decades that very much hindered our ability to advance an economic agenda that was for all of Baltimore. Sadly, redlining began in Baltimore. And you cannot have a conversation about that looking backwards and not recognize that there were policies, procedures, and programs in place that hindered economic growth from effectively helping all of Baltimore. And so what we see as the priority for Baltimore moving forward is to make sure that our policies, programs, and procedures actually have intentionality around opening up access, opening up opportunity. And so, yes, the measurement of success is in and around whether or not people move from being the sole proprietor to being able to hire two people, whether they went from earning $50,000 a year to now $70,000 a year. We want to shift away from just looking at outputs and actually look at outcomes.
And a lot of that, it seems to me, knowing very little about, you know, your particular business, has to do with mechanics, has to do with what the city can provide to these businesses. It has to do with the permit process, the zoning process.
Most
it's
different.
Not just a sort of philosophical approach that says, oh yeah, it's a big tent, we all got to get under it and prosper. What sort of input do you expect to have, do you need to have in order to do your part in this puzzle? You know, what do you need from the city?
Well, a couple of things. One, you know, the mayor just appointed Justin Williams to be the permits czar, recognizing how important it is that transparency, predictability, and ease of service, particularly as it relates to permits and acquiring those permits and are to businesses. The mayor's, you know, I think has had a lot of wisdom in terms of thinking through what things do we need to do differently in terms of the existing system. And so now there's one person who's that's their job to really advance their work. So I think that's one piece. It is, though, I mentioned transparency and predictability because I will never forget when I was a planning director here in Baltimore, a developer who had been doing work in San Francisco was complaining to me about the process here. And I said, well, hold on a second, because I knew the 93 steps you had to go through in San Francisco to get anything done. So I was like, hold on a second, it's a lot easier in Baltimore. And he said, no, this, let me explain to you. The difference between San Francisco at this time, the difference between San Francisco and Baltimore is the predictability. He said, yes, there are 93 steps I have to go through, but I know what they are, right? And if I'm planning for how I expend my money and my resources, both human and financial resources, if I know what needs to be done, then I can plan accordingly. The challenge I have when I'm trying to do business here in Baltimore is the unpredictability. Right. It might be three steps, but if I have to guess at two of them, that costs me time, energy, money, resources. And so that's I took that as a lesson learned, you know, many, many moons ago, back when I had hair, that, you know, it's so important if you're serious about economic development to try to make sure that the policies, the programs, what you have to do to get things done in the city is clear, and that there's a level of predictability and especially transparency so that those, whether it's a small, medium-sized, or large business, they're able to navigate it. You shouldn't need a special cheat code, so to speak, to try to understand how to play the game. I see it as BDC's responsibility to remove that, the necessity of that cheat code, and to really work with city agencies in collaboration, coordination, communication to meet an agenda that we all have, which is for the city to prosper.
Otis Raleigh is my guest. He is the new president and CEO of the BDC, the Baltimore Development Corporation. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. What's your understanding? For example, you mentioned Justin Williams, who's now going to be in charge of permits and fixing that. It is a long-standing problem. There's a new software that's been installed, you know, that's supposed to automate the permit process. That software apparently is a disaster. It's just not working very well. There are dreadfully fewer permits being issued this year than there were last year under a system that everybody didn't like last year. So, you know, it's a real issue. How do you see it? I mean, I just wonder, as coming back to town with a newish, you know, set of eyes on what's going on for that kind of thing, because that is so key to businesses. It's so key to residents, too, you know, who are trying to fix up their homes. And it's so frustrating to so many people. And I have talked to the mayor about it, and he says, well, Justin Williams is going to go fix everything. And I hope he does. You know, that's great. But how do you see the problem? What do we need to fix about that particular part of this puzzle?
Ooh, great question. So I think at the end of the day, the technology is a solution if you understand the process and the processes that are occurring. Whether it's the public sector, private sector, you can try to automate a broken process and then be surprised that it didn't solve all problems, right? I think one of the things that the mayor—
Yeah, if it's broke to begin with and you automate it, it's going to be automatically broken.
That's exactly right. You know, and so I think part of what I understand that the mayor has charged Justin to do is to really make sure there's a clear understanding and communication of the various processes necessary to advance these permits. And then how do we make sure that we have the technological solution to streamline and to expedite those processes? And, you know, I think somehow the cart may have gotten in front of the horse and some other things, but we, instead of looking backwards, really trying to focus in on, you know, fail fast, learn fast, fix fast. And I think that's the key. If we know, because there's so much interdependency, there's so many various agencies that are involved, DPW, finance, fire, et cetera, planning, that is so important that whoever is in charge with doing this work, as Justin has been tasked with, it's so important that they understand the workflows, all the processes, so that then they can find the best technological solution to get it done. And I'm certain that, you know, the mayor and his wisdom has found the right person to do that. And I know for a fact that the city administrator has called, you know, kind of all of the various city agencies to all kind of get in line and kind of charge in behind Justin to try to make sure that we have success, because it's vital to our success.
Because the other part of it, of course, is the ongoing, you know, centuries-long debate about whether the government should be involved at all in development. You know, we live in a market economy. You know, if a developer sees a opportunity for, you know, a market success, that person should go in and, you know, have at it. This came up, you know, somewhat recently with Harbor Place. You know, we have David Bramble from MCB Real Estate wanting to develop the harbor. He owns it. It's his thing. The city sold it to him. And the city is agreeing to give him about $400 million to help the process along. The whole thing is going to cost, I think, $900 million, something like that, $750, whatever. So what's your take on what the capacity of the government is to begin with, and how we put a price tag on that? Because there's plenty of folks who say, why is Bramble getting $400 million from us? You know, he's a private developer. Let him go develop it on his own.
Well, I think if anyone said to me or to you that government shouldn't be involved in the marketplace, then I would laugh first. And then secondly, I would ask them to visit one of the many Enoch Pratt public libraries and do a little research. If they didn't feel like going to our fabulous library system, I would ask them then to Google. And the reason I would say that is because if you look at the history of our great country, government has always been involved. We've always recognized the need to for there to be public-private kind of partnerships. The marketplace does not take care of itself by itself. And left on its own, anyone who understands capitalism or the theory of capitalism would understand that racialized capitalism doesn't work, right? Capitalism that helps to bring about monopolies and oligarchies does not work, right? But if we are serious about a fair marketplace, an equitable one, one in which is actually subscribes to what, you know, true capitalism theory subscribes to, then yes, the government has a role to play. And that sometimes will be around incentives, that will sometimes be around regulation. I do not subscribe to the Reagan philosophy that, you know, the public sector is idiots and that the smaller the government, the better it can be. I just firmly believe that efficient excellence in public sector, private sector will actually help to create prosperity. And so the other piece, as we look at Harvard Place, is that we, I think it's so important, particularly for all of our listeners, remember that this wasn't an RFP. It had gone into receivership. He went to court, right, and got it, right? And so this is...
And a lot of people blame all sorts of prior administrations to the Scott administration for allowing it to get into receivership. And people say, this is the gem of our city, you know, Harvard Place, and all of a sudden... It's just, you know, falling to pot.
And I think it is a relatively fair critique, but it's contrary to and conflicts with the thought, though, that the public sector should not be involved, right? Because the market obviously didn't take care of Harbor Place, right? So you can't in one voice say, doggone, the government should have done something to make sure that the private sector actually invested in and did the things that they should have been doing at Harbor Place. That same person who says that can't then say, why is the government involved? You have to pick a lane, right? And I think the reality is where we have seen success in the U.S. government, in the state of Maryland, throughout the country, in the city of Baltimore, is when there is a reasonable partnership, public-private partnership between the private sector and the public sector. And that can't be one in which the city is so grateful for anybody who will bring private capital to Baltimore that we acquiesce and undervalue ourselves and our great city. And it can't be the other side either, where we are ignoring the needs for profit and profit margins of the private sector for them to be a real partner. There has to be a happy medium. I have frequently said that sometimes Baltimore acted like a very attractive man or woman who was dating beneath themselves. They were really attractive. They were really bright. And yet they didn't recognize how talented they were, how what skills and resources and prowess that, you know, that they had. And so they were dating people who also didn't recognize it and acted accordingly. And I think we are in a time and space as a city where we're starting to realize how awesome we are. And that we deserve partners who also recognize how awesome we are. And those will be true partners.
And we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about this Baltimore Together initiative. We'll talk about things like Harbor Place and others and the extent to which the community can be involved in developing the ideas to make them happen and how that is coordinated by your office, which is the Baltimore Development Corporation. Otis Raleigh is the new president and CEO, and we'll have more with Otis Raleigh on the other side of a quick break. You can join us at 410-662-8780. You can email us midday@wipr.org. We have an email from T. Guthrie that we are going to be exploring and sharing on the other side of a break. So I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
You're listening to Midday on 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, Dr. Jeffrey Kahn will join me. He's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics. He'll be here for another installment of Midday on Ethics. We'll talk about organ donation and medical aid in dying and a reproductive technology that leads to what is known as three-parent babies. So we'll talk about that tomorrow here on Midday. And if you just joined us today, we're talking about economic development in Baltimore with the new president and CEO of the Baltimore Development Corporation, Otis Raleigh. He joins me in Studio A. You are welcome to join us as well. Our number here, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. So we were talking a little bit before the break about Harbor Plays. About a year and a half ago, a year and a few months ago, May of 2024, you moderated this forum about the future of Harbor Plays. So you heard a mouthful, an earful about, you know, what Harbor Plays should be. So there are folks who are saying, well, not only should we not be giving David Bramble $400 million, but, you know, the idea he's come up with for this project, which makes it financially viable for him, including apartments that are right on the waterfront there, is, you know, considered anathema by some people. Now, he's still got, we're a long way away from anything happening at Harbor Place. He's got to raise a whole bunch of money before anything starts happening. But in terms of the BDC, the Baltimore Development Corporation, what is the role here then in understanding and figuring out a sort of overall plan for what all of these large developments, Harbor East, the Harbor Place, Camden Yards, which, you know, may or may not get developed in the next few years. Is there a plan? Is there an overall notion, an overarching notion of what the city should look like, you know, all the way from the stadiums through Harbor Place over to Harbor East and Harbor Point?
So the short answer is yes. So first and foremost, there's a comprehensive city plan that is led by the Baltimore City Department of Planning. It was approved by the Planning Commission and the City Council, only the second comprehensive city plan to be approved by City Council in our city's history. But the reality is that, yes, there's an overarching plan for which not just myself as leading BDC, but every city agency should be following and subscribing to. There's also Downtown Rise, which is a visioning and kind of collaborative planning exercise that involves looking not just at Harbor Place, but all of downtown, Harbor East, all of the Central Business District, et cetera. And mapping out a potential kind of course of action there. So yes, there are adopted master plans and strategy documents that lay out what could and should go in all of these places. And again, to my earlier point, it's then up to us then to follow them with fidelity. You raised the points around Harbor Place, and the reality is, you know, God bless democracy. It went to the city voters. It overwhelmingly passed, and so it's a done deal, right? I know it is not in conflict with the overarching citywide master plan or Downtown Rise. And so, being that it is consistent with both, and being that there was an extensive public process with both of those before they were adopted, it's then now our job to help in this execution.
Chris Ryer is the head of the Director of Planning. It's an office you held back in the day.
Yes.
He's been with the city 40-some years, I think, and he's leaving, or he has left already. I've lost track. But there's a new opportunity for, you know, a new set of eyes, a new perspective there. What can you tell us about the Department of Planning and how your office works with that department?
Well, Tom, as you know, I'm a trained urban planner. I got my master's in city planning from MIT. I love planning. I love planners. And I think because you have to have a very kind of comprehensive approach at looking at systems and how they interplay. And I think so I'm slightly biased, but I think the plan department is poised to really take things to the next level. I think Chris is leaving it, Director Ryer is leaving it in a good place, and I think the mayor is really close to selecting the new planning director, who I'm pretty certain that I think Baltimore and the surrounding communities and the state are going to be really proud of the type of leader that that the mayor is going to be able to attract to lead it. And I can't wait to work with the new planning director, as we worked successfully with Director Ryer and his team, but to take it even to the next level with the new director around advancing the city's overarching goals.
Let's go to a question from a listener, T. Guthrie, who says, Baltimore boasts an amazing cooperative and worker-owned businesses. They afford a level of economic stability that other models can't meet. These community-based co-ops have an inherent commitment and connection to the health and growth of community. What are the plans to bolster investment and growth in this sector We can no longer bear financial investment in outside companies only to be ghosted a few years later. And that's a good point. You know, oftentimes you lay out the red carpet and then in a year or two, they're gone.
Yeah, and that was part of what I was talking about at the beginning of the conversation. Yeah, we are very much interested in looking how we can invest further in co-ops and how they exist. We have our Made in Baltimore program in Baltimore celebrating 10 years where we look at the makers, the creatives, the entrepreneurs in Baltimore and how we can provide contextualized technical assistance and support and marketing to them. But directly towards the question that was asked, we will be exploring a variety of different tools to support both traditional and non-traditional approaches to entrepreneurship and business ownership. We have a great partnership already in the Emerson Village area with an organization called Trend. Lanier Richardson out of New Jersey, who's doing work in Baltimore and Chicago and in New Jersey, has a cooperative kind of community-funded approach to the redevelopment and community ownership of the redevelopment of Emerson Village, and we've been supportive of that. I had the opportunity to be supportive both at the at Rockefeller, at Wells Fargo, and now at BDC. It is not something that's new to me. I've seen its success elsewhere, and I think those types of things here in Baltimore.
When you were giving away money at Rockefeller and Wells Fargo, you had to assess, you know, the viability, the advisability, the value of the projects that people were asking for. Now you've got to make that case. How do you make the case for the city of Baltimore? If someone says, I have a company in Hagerstown, I have a company in Akron, Ohio, and I'm thinking of moving it to Baltimore or having opening another branch of it in Baltimore. What's the pitch? What do we have on the upside to sell Baltimore? And then conversely, what do we got to work on? What are the deficits that we've certainly got to address in the eyes of these businesses, large or small?
Well, first and foremost, I would say in my philanthropic work, it was never just giving away money. I definitely always saw it as a philanthropic investment. And with any investment, you're looking for a return on investment, right? And so as it relates to Baltimore, I think the pitch here is that Baltimore's better. Like it is much more affordable here in terms of a place to live, a place to own a business, to operate a business. Baltimore has the assets and resources, the public transportation and infrastructure that I think can meet the needs of businesses at a lower cost than in many other cities. I also, as I'm pitching the city, you know, I don't just talk about our harbor, but I talk about our neighborhoods. I talk about our parks. I talk about the livability and the culture. Baltimore, as you know, has been is as many people refer to us as Charm City, because it is truly a city that is exceptionally charming. If you spend a little bit of time here, you get pulled in. I originally moved to Baltimore in 1998 with every intention of leaving after 2 years. I fell in love hard with the city, and it was easy to do that because of all the assets, the great art and museums and culture and food, and most importantly, the people. And I think there are some places where you can go to where there's a reputation of the people being mean. There's some places you can go to with a reputation can be one thing or the other. I think Baltimore has a strong and current reputation around culture and community that makes it attractive to anybody wanting to do business. And that's why I'm here, and that's why I'm trying to get other people to come here. And when they come, I want to make sure that the people who've been here, particularly during the harder times, have an opportunity to be part of the prosperity that's going to occur.
I'm interested because when you list the positives about our city, one of the things that came to your mind was public transportation. There are a lot of folks who think that's a deficit, that it's just not nearly as advanced as it needs to be. It's not as easy to get around as it is in Boston or in Philadelphia or in Washington. Talk about transportation and the role that plays.
The reason I cite it as a positive is because at the very least we have the bones and the infrastructure and the systems in place, whether they need to be improved
upon. You can't get to work on the bones,
man. No, that's more than fair. That's more than fair. But I think but we're not starting from scratch, right? And I think the problem you have, as you know, formerly many moons ago, I led the Central Maryland Transportation Alliance and was always fighting as I looked at what was done in D.C. and what was done in the Baltimore metro area. There's a lot of opportunity for us to build off of. We don't have to build a new subway system. We have a subway system, right? How do we improve upon it? We're not having conversations about, oh, doggone it, if only we had some existing bus lines from here to there. They exist, but how do we improve upon it, right? And I think we have the right partners at the state level, at MTA, and within the city, and I think we have the right advocates to go from good to great, right? As opposed to having to start from scratch, and so that's why I cite it, because I do think it is a benefit to that we have the MTA here and that we have the partnership that we have with the state in and around it to meet the needs of employers and employees trying to get to from work. But is there room for improvement? Heck yeah.
Otis Raleigh is my guest. He is the new president and CEO, new as of June, of the Baltimore Development Corporation, 410-662-8780. If you want to jump in, our email, midday@wypr.org. We do have a few emails I want to share with you, Otis. Klaus Philipson, our good friend and very well-known urban planner, says, what are you going to do with the super block now that it's been even more diminished by the big fire last week? What's your thinking about how to make something happen there after more than 20 years? This is a big fire, 5-alarm fire that happened last Tuesday, I believe. And this was something that had certainly been on the radar screen of BDC. There had even been some memos discovered by the Baltimore Banner, our news partner, saying that the BDC was warning the city that, hey, we've got some issues over here with some of these vacant buildings. That's been one of those projects that people have been looking at and saying, oh, this is a gem, we got to fix this. I've been hearing that for a long time.
as have I. Well, as you know, we've had the Baltimore Development Corporation has had the property since 2007. Just point of correction, the memos weren't discovered. They weren't confidential or hidden memos. The memos to the mayor's office was actually seeking to get some resources from the opioid settlement to deploy towards the super block, because, as you know, it's not a low price tag in terms of what needs to be done there. But what I would say is this, that when I came, I've been on board now for 2 months. I asked our team to do environmental assessments so we could get some current information in terms of where the buildings are, the structures were. My hat goes off to our superior firefighters, the fire department, successfully made sure we only lost two buildings. It could have been much, much worse, particularly given the fact that these buildings were vacant. But through the superiority of their firefighting skills, we only lost two of them. And my intention is to, once we have the information and intelligence that we need, to then explore what makes sense in terms of next steps there. We, in the past, have done several RFPs. It wasn't just the city. As you know, there have been various private developers who have tried and failed. We have not been sitting on our hands. There's been at least four different partnerships that we attempted to do. So part of it may include us, figuring out a path forward in which we are the developers. As I've done in Newark and in other cities, the Economic Development Agency sometimes will actually lead the development as opposed to just doing the RFP. I know Klaus probably would not like this, but I will say stay tuned. I need to make sure that we have all the information that we need. There have been countless plans done So it's not a planning issue. It's really a resource issue. And once I have all the data points in terms of where the structures actually are right now in terms of viability, then we're going to be making some recommendations to the mayor and to the broader community around how do we preserve and prosper at the same time. How do we go to changing, because these are, most of them are historic buildings. That, you know, we don't want them burnt down. We don't want them torn down. We want them repurposed in a way that makes sense in the 21st century. And not just, you know, just for historic preservation's sake, but for prosperity's sake and for the community's sake. And so once I have all the information, we'll be coming back to the community and to the mayor with some ideas on a path forward.
Yeah, and of course, when it comes to public transportation, it's right there on the light rail. I mean, the light rail just runs right down the Howard Street. It's right there.
And that's why, as I mentioned earlier, that I do see some of these things as benefits, even where there's opportunities for improvement. Because, for example, the MTA, I had a meeting with them a couple of weeks ago, and which they shared with me, they have over $1 billion, with a B, cited and dedicated towards light rail improvements, right? And so this is a huge opportunity. How do we leverage that $1 billion investment and the improvements that are going to have to be made to do everything that we want to do on Howard Street and around the super block? And of course, those dollars are dedicated for light rail and light rail improvement, but it's an awesome time to try to leverage that towards some TOD, transit-oriented development opportunities that would make a lot of sense. So I think the timing is right.
Otis Raleigh is the president and CEO of the Baltimore Development Corporation. The annual Baltimore Together Summit, by the way, will be held on October 27th this year. It's going to be at the M&T Bank Exchange or at the Hippodrome Theater in West Baltimore. And we've got a link to register for that event on our website at wypr.org/midday. We will have more with Otis Raleigh and more of your questions and comments after a quick break. You can join us at 410-662-8780 or email us midday@wypr.org. And before we go to that break, each week here on Midday, it's our practice to read the names of people who've lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City and to list their names on the Midday webpage. We do this to stand in witness to their untimely deaths and to remember their families and friends in their hour of grief. So far this year, 92 people have been identified as victims of homicide in our city. Police have identified two people who were killed last week. They are Major Kip Smith, age 61, and Davion Hodges. He was 25 years old. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Midday here on your local NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Otis Raleigh. After serving in the public, private, and nonprofit sectors in Baltimore and in cities around the country, he has returned to Baltimore to be the president and CEO of the Baltimore Development Corporation, which oversees economic development for our city. We're talking about how to implement an equitable economic development strategy, one that doesn't necessarily focus just on large corporate entities, but rather seeks to grow small businesses to spur economic expansion. Otis Raleigh joins me in Studio A. We would love to have you join us as well. 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. So, Otis, we have an email from Anne in Baltimore who says, can you tell us about investment in the Baltimore Peninsula, formerly called Port Covington? Whose money is invested in the East Peninsula near the Hanover Street Bridge and further east near the Rye Street Tavern? How's this investment benefiting all of the citizens of Baltimore? And might all the new housing on the peninsula be competing with other areas in Baltimore that also need investment and development and population growth. And by the way, the peninsula looks spectacular. So when we talk about equitable, I mean, you know, if you give it to one place, does that necessarily, is it a zero-sum game? Does that mean the other place doesn't get it?
Absolutely not. Yeah. I want to say for the record, the scarcity model is dead, right? Please, as Baltimoreans, we've got to stop believing the lie that the pie is only big enough for a few people to eat. The pie is big enough for us, everyone in Baltimore, to have a slice and to eat well, particularly because we made the pie. So I don't see the new housing in Port Covington as competition for other parts of the city of Baltimore. It adds to, does not take away from Baltimore as a whole. It's just in the same way, you know, if my partner prospers, I prosper, right? If parts of the city are being invested in, we have to think about how that investment actually adds to the tax base as a whole, allows the city to do the things that are necessary to invest in all parts of the city. And so I'm pleased with the level of investment. It is both public and private investment in Port Covington. In answer to the question being asked, there were, as you know, the city resources that went into it, as well as private dollars that are going into the construction and development of homes and businesses there. But it's not the only place where that's happening. It's happening in Wanata and the West North Avenue development area, where there are public and private investments happening. We're seeing it in Park Heights Renaissance and the Park Heights community. Those 12 neighborhoods are getting the state and city investments that they have sorely needed. One that did the Park Heights Master Plan a little bit over 20 years ago, now seeing those dollars go towards housing and libraries and the rebuilding of Pimlico. We see it happening in the Poppleton area with the University of Maryland and Home Free USA doing development in and around there. We see the life sciences growing. So I mentioned that not to take away in any way from, because I don't think it does. It doesn't take away from Port Covington. It just shows that the city recognizes that you can chew and walk at the same time, right? There are multiple investments that have to occur, and it's not just downtown. It's throughout the city that's going to help us to be a whole city that prospers. And that's really the crux behind Baltimore Together. It's really around Baltimore prospering together. It is not a social call. It is a name of our comprehensive economic development strategy. We try to get together at least once a year and talk about some of the work that is underway. And then also once a year report out on metrics, because we can talk about it all we want, but we need to be held accountable, hold ourselves accountable, and let the community hold us accountable as well about progress that we're making. And so really I'm hoping as many people as possible can register and join us in October for Baltimore Together, but then also to be part of the process throughout the year of us investing in our city.
You know, the tension between what's planned and what's able to be implemented quickly is always, you know, just part of the deal here. And as an impatient person yourself, I'm sure it's very frustrating. You know, Super Block is super slow.
Yes.
Let's face it, you know, and Port Covington, which used to be, or it's now Baltimore Peninsula, after long negotiations about affordable housing being included and jobs being created for both the construction and the sustenance of the businesses down there, it's slowed down and the plans have been scaled back. Under Armour was going to have originally a much bigger, larger footprint. They have a smaller footprint. Stuff happens. So you all have got to be nimble, and you've got to be nimble in an economic environment now that's very difficult to predict. I could say with some assuredness that Baltimore, the city of Baltimore, is probably not the favorite city of the folks residing at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue these days. How do you see the situation with federal subsidies and federal funding and the overall economy in general?
Well, first of all, I think I've always been, as a city planner, I've always been biased in thinking that, you know, things begin and end at the city level and township level, right? So whether we have the support at the federal level or not, I think cities and states have the level, they have their boots on the ground in terms of understanding the needs of the communities. And have an opportunity now more than ever to really be the vanguard in leading how to collaborate and coordinate and communicate in a way that's going to lead to the best possible outcomes for the citizens. I would say plans are never static. They have never been static, right? I think where we can do a better job, particularly at BDC, is helping folks to understand the particulars around the economy and the ebbs and flows that exist, and to recognize a plan is not necessarily a promise; it's a plan, right? And so people feel like, oh, well, the plan said such and such, and you broke your promise. I was like, whoa, the plan said such and such, but that also had certain level of expectations in terms of private investment, in terms of where the economy is. You know, no matter what the plan was, COVID happens. You know, the plan has to change. No matter what the plan says, if there's a downshift in the economy, the plan has to change. And I think we owe it to the citizens of Baltimore to just be a lot more transparent and open in terms of communicating what we're seeing, what we're experiencing as a local, state, and national economy. And whether people want to receive it or not is up to them. But we have a job to communicate it. And I think if we share the plans and share the progress, whether good or bad, in a much more open and transparent way, I think then we'll have the cheerleaders and the support and making sure that we are a lot more successful.
Tell us a little bit about commercial district assessments. I guess you're looking at how to acquire data in a different way. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's possible that the data we were acquiring in the past wasn't telling us enough or wasn't telling us the right stuff.
Well, to be 100% transparent, that we weren't acquiring. That was the part of the problem, right? We're trying to just be smarter in how we apply our resources, particularly for commercial revitalization at the neighborhood level. It was funny. I don't know, Tom, if you remember, but when ComStat happened and CityStat happened, people were like, hold on a second. The police weren't capturing this data and using it before? And they were like, no, right? and then what seemed like a really commonsensical approach of getting all the crime data, analyzing it, and then allocating your resources appropriately all of a sudden seemed revolutionary. But it was also like a duh. Right. And in many ways, we're sadly a little slow to it here, but we've waken up and recognized that how important the data is, how important it's going to be in telling and showing us where and how we need to allocate our resources. And so that's why we're excited. The first results of what we learned is going to be shared out actually at the summit, and it's our intention to be able to try to do this for all the commercial revitalization districts in the city.
Yeah, and we think about what used to be the business district.
That's right.
I'm talking about in the past tense because it's just ain't nothing going on down there now. And Harbor Place, obviously, a big part of that. But Harbor Place could be a 10 or 15 year project. I mean, it's right. Another long time. So patience is going to be required.
No doubt. Well. But there are also some commercial districts that are doing well.
Yeah.
And so the more information we have on how to help them do even better, we want to do that.
Otis Raleigh, the president and CEO of the Baltimore Development Corporation. Thanks so much for coming in, and let's have you come in regularly so we can keep folks up to date.
I would love to do that. Thanks,
Appreciate
Tom.
It. Okay, the 4th Annual Baltimore Together Summit takes place next month. We've got a link to register on our website. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, it's Midday on Ethics with Dr. Jeff Kahn. Now on Fresh Air, the singer-songwriter Billy Strings. So stick around for that. Thanks for being with me. I'm Tom Hall. Have a great day.
This is 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.